1 Chronicles chapter 2, the sons of Judah, verse 3, the sons of Judah were Onan and Shelah, which three were born of him, to him of Shuah's daughter, the Canaanitess. Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of Yahweh, and he killed him. Well, these genealogies are full of allusion to the weakness of the fathers of Judah, that really they did not come from great spiritual stock. He was there marrying a Canaanitess. He wasn't supposed to have a relationship with her, have children by her, and then Tamar, his daughter-in-law, bore him Perez and Zerah. Well, remember the old go with Tamar, she dresses up like a prostitute, and he's coming back from sheep shearing, and I presume a bit drunk, and he thinks she's a prostitute, sleeps with her, doesn't realize that it's actually his own daughter-in-law, and, well, she gets pregnant with twins and so forth. The whole beginnings of God's people were absolutely weak as. And I think that was to show them in the bigger picture, and these genealogies are being written for the exiles as they return to Judah, hopefully to re-establish God's kingdom, that really their being the people of God was all of grace, absolutely all of grace, and they were not to have this idea that, oh, I'm from a great pedigree and I'm continuing the great pedigree. All this kind of pride in family is all rather destroyed by these genealogies, keeping on just chipping, mentioning the terrible weakness of these people. Anyway, so he has this son, it just says, well, Yahweh killed him because he sinned. But then he sleeps with his daughter-in-law, and she gives birth to Perez and Zerah. Verse 5, the sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. Hamul means the one who was spared. And I think the idea is, well, and Onan were killed, and yet this Hamul was spared. As if, well, he also did wrong, but God spared him. When God encounters sin, which he does all the time, he can react in a number of ways. The wages of sin is death. And there are a few, just a few, cases in the Bible where you read of God killing people pretty much immediately. And Onan were killed straight out. They sinned. Bang, you're dead. You think of Uzzah. He touched the ark when it was on the carriage, which it shouldn't have been on, and the oxen stumble, and the guy puts his hand out to steady it, bang, he touches it, and he's killed. Ananias and Sapphira, they sold their property, gave, I would imagine, most of it to the church, but they lied about it to just make the sum look a bit bigger. I don't suppose they lied too much, they exaggerated too much, because it would have seemed obviously untrue. They lied, bang, one by one, they're killed. You think of the prophet who goes to Bethel and he faithfully gives the message, and God says, don't eat or drink anything and don't return by the way in which you came. Here's a message from another prophet that says, oh, well done, nice job, come back to my place, I've had a word from the Lord, you ought to come back to my place, return by the way you went, and eat with me. And he does, bang, he's killed by a lion. There's a few other examples of this kind of thing, and yet the vast majority of examples of how God deals with sin are of sparing people, of endless, it seems, patience with Israel, with wicked kings like Manasseh, giving them a long life, like, do awful things, sacrifice children, do all sorts of things, and they apparently get away with it and go on. All sorts of people committing major sin, but and God being very patient, overlooking, that something else God does, overlooks sin even without repentance, reconciles with people, and so on. And yet, other times, he, bang, just kills people for their sin. And I think that that is intentional, because it is to remind us, these cases you get like and Onan are there to remind you that, in fact, the wages of sin is death. Quote, just, in between the commas, just one sin nets death, straight up. That's it. We have all sinned, and sinned grievously, sinned multiple times a day. And yet we are spared, like this one Hamul was, the one who was spared. And these things are there to remind us that really and truly we live by absolute grace. Every breath you take is an extra, is grace. Think of Moses. He spoke inadvisedly with his lips under provocation. He hits the rocks that are speaking it to it and says, "Must we bring you rebels water out of this rock?" Bang, you can't enter the promised land. And you think, oh, poor guy, you know. That's how naturally we would judge it, that haven't we all snapped a bit under pressure? Sure, of course we have. And, you know, it seems a pretty major judgment. But, you know, this is all to remind us. Of course, these odd occasional reminders of immediate judgment for sin, such as we've read here, Ur and Onan, they are just inserted here and there into the overall narrative of God's amazing grace, patience, overlooking sin, not judging sin immediately. That's the basic meta-narrative of the whole Bible. But now and again, you just get these reminders just to keep us grounded in humility and in reality that sin nets death and you actually, as it were, deserve it immediately. And you need that, because otherwise grace becomes cheap. And because grace becomes cheap, you lose that sense of reality, that sense of commitment to God. You lose that sense of urgency, not to sin, that motivation to self-control, that motivation to praise, to zeal, to gratitude, as I say, to humility. Once you cheapen grace, and that's why, as I say, studied in the meta-narrative of God's huge grace and patience with people, overlooking sin, etc., seeing things the best possible way, putting the best construction on things, within all that meta-narrative, you just have these reminders of people like Ur and Onan who sinned, bang, they were killed. And we are not to say, well, no, that was unreasonable. No, it's absolutely reasonable. Once you realize and allow yourself to be reminded of the nature of sin and that the wages of sin is indeed death.